Hello, and welcome to Science World.
We can simply take the data recorded by seismometers, and just by some simple modifications, we can actually hear how the ground shakes during and immediately after the big event.
Have you ever listened to an earthquake? A seismologist in Georgia has made it possible to listen to the magnitude 9 earthquake that rocked Japan 1 year ago on Sunday. Apple rolls out its latest version of its popular iPad tablet computer, and scientists have come up with a new superadhesive modeled after the feet of a gecko. These stories and more next on VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Sunday marks 1 year since a powerful earthquake and tsunami struck the northeast coast of Japan, killing 20,000 people and displacing 340,000 more. The disaster caused severe damage at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, triggering a partial meltdown and releasing potentially dangerous radiation over a wide area. 1 year later, scientists and energy experts are questioning whether nuclear power can ever be developed economically or managed safely. Roseanne Skirbel has the report.
The Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant was designed to withstand the largest tsunami ever to hit Japan. A 1960 event linked to a 9.5 magnitude earthquake in Chile, the largest earthquake in recorded history. The earthquake that struck Japan last March was a magnitude 9.0, setting off a tsunami that crippled the Fukushima plant. Thorne Lay is a seismologist with the University of California, Santa Cruz. He says the chances that a great wave could shut down the emergency backup systems at the power plant had been underestimated.
Those were mostly design weaknesses that, you know, a good engineering think through might say, well, let's put the backup power at very high elevation so that it could not possibly get drowned out. There are things that we could do better, and that often is the case with very complex technical systems that we build that we don't anticipate all the failure points.
The Japanese earthquake was one of a series of large quakes around the world in recent years. From them, scientists have learned that one quake can closely follow another, that they can occur in shallow parts of faults and not just in deep waters, and that they can occur across an ocean ridge. Scientists now understand more about how and where earthquakes occur, but despite its growing ability to anticipate risk in certain regions, Lay says, science cannot provide decision makers with all the answers.
What people have to do if they live in areas with earthquake potential is recognize, well, the scientists are going to do their best to identify the long-term shaking hazard that guides engineering and construction standards. We'll try to do our best to give early warning if that's possible and set up emergency response systems. But ultimately, individuals have to prepare themselves.
Safety is just one concern for the nuclear power industry. Since the Chernobyl nuclear accident in Russia in 1986, nations have been rethinking the economics of nuclear power, says Peter Bradford, a former member of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The cost of building a nuclear plant and generating electricity from it is much higher than other sources of power.
Nuclear just hasn't been able to compete in the power markets. Investors just won't take the risk of somehow being able to make money by selling 12-cent kilowatt hours in a 5 or 6 cent market.
The price of natural gas in some areas is that low, and in addition, Bradford says, the demand for electricity has fallen.
When you add to that the fact that the public has now seen several reactors blow up on their television screens, politicians have seen the fall of the Japanese government largely as a result of the accident, thousands of people being unable to return to their homes, and liability estimates that started $100 billion, that certainly has made the nuclear case even harder to make.
But a new plant is under construction in the U.S. state of Georgia, the country's first since the 1979 Three Mile Island nuclear disaster in Pennsylvania. The cost will be passed on to customers. Even if that plant is built on time and on budget, Bradford says, it's still a recipe for going broke, given the current power market. But he points out that doesn't mean nuclear can't and isn't working elsewhere.
The Chinese, for example, are still building a substantial number of new reactors. And that's really the paradigm, the only paradigm that can still work for new nuclear is a strong central government that's committed to making the public, either as taxpayers or as customers, pay the cost.
For some, nuclear power is justified by its primary virtue. It is clean energy. The problem is balancing that virtue against the financial and environmental risks. The role for nuclear in the energy power marketplace and how it can be managed safely will be on the agenda later this month when world leaders gather at the Nuclear Security Summit in Seoul, South Korea. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
The Apple Computer Company introduced a new version of its popular iPad this week.
Today we're announcing the new iPad, and it is amazing. We've taken it to a whole new level, and we are redefining the category that Apple created with the original iPad. It makes amazing improvements over the most fundamental features of the design of the device, while retaining everything that millions of people have grown to love about it.
That was Apple's CEO, Tim Cook. The new iPad mobile computer has a sharper 25-centimeter screen, an improved built-in camera, and the ability to use a faster method to access the Internet. Apple's iPad is the best-selling of the so-called tablet computers, and the improvements are apparently designed to help keep its market share. Apple's CEO, Tim Cook, says that the iPad is the poster child of the post-PC world as more consumers switch from traditional desktop and laptop computers. A new study highlights the value of treating epilepsy patients with brain surgery if they don't improve with anti-epilepsy drugs. As we hear from health reporter Art Chimes, many patients for whom drugs proved ineffective when treated surgically stopped having seizures.
The study involved patients who had a form of epilepsy that commonly resists drug treatment. Surgery is an alternative. In fact, it's been used for more than 100 years. But according to the head of the Seizure Disorder Center at UCLA, the University of California, Los Angeles, most epilepsy patients who are not helped by medicine don't have surgery, or they wait years before they try it.
The sad fact is that those patients who are referred for surgery today, those few patients who are referred an average of 22 years after the onset of their epilepsy. And by this time, it's just too late to make a difference in their lives.
Dr. Jerome Engel, Jr. is the lead author of a new study of patients who had surgery within 2 years after it became apparent that drugs alone weren't working.
If you operate on patients, then 85% in this study were seizure-free, and none of the patients who just continued to have medical care were seizure-free. And there was a statistically significant improvement in quality of life among those patients who had surgery,
compared to those who took anti-epilepsy drugs. Memory impairment is sometimes a side effect of this surgery, which after all involves cutting out part of the brain. But this study was too small to be conclusive on that question. Engel says, however, that if surgery did have an impact on memory, it was outweighed by improvements in quality of life related to being seizure-free. Engel says he hopes the results of this study will encourage doctors to consider surgery as a treatment option.
We're hoping to use the study to publicize the fact that there should not be a delay in referring patients, but not only that, that patients who continue to have seizures are at risk for all kinds of problems in the future, including, as I said, premature death.
Engel says only about 1% of U.S. epilepsy patients who might benefit from surgery are referred to specialized epilepsy treatment centers. He said the surgery is widely used around the world. He cites the example of Brazil, where officials determine that it's more cost-effective to surgically treat epilepsy than pay for the ongoing cost of seizures. The research paper by Jerome Engel, Jr. on epilepsy surgery is published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA. This is Art Chimes reporting.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the Internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Imagine a super adhesive material that grips so strong an index card sized piece could hold more than 300 kilograms against a flat wall. Scientists have developed just such a powerful adhesive by studying the feet of the tiny gecko lizard. Jessica Berman has more.
For over a century, scientists around the world have tried to figure out how the tiny gecko, a lizard weighing barely 140 grams, can climb up a smooth vertical surface or saunter nonchalantly across the ceiling with a grip that would take a 4-kilogram bag of apples to break. Developing a material that can mimic the adhesive strength of the gecko's tiny footpads would be very desirable and have almost unlimited commercial and military applications. Key to the gecko's climbing and clinging ability are the millions of microscopic hairs or setae that cover the bottom of the lizard's flexible footpads. The setae are so fine that they actually form an electrostatic bond with the molecules of whatever object the lizards are scaling. And as powerful as their foothold is, geckos can release it with just a bend of their wrist as they move along a surface. Researchers have managed to simulate the gripping power of the tiny hairs using nanotechnology. But Duncan Ershik, a functional morphologist or physical structures expert at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, says they haven't yet been able to make artificial setae work at the scale needed to hold on to really heavy objects. So Ershik and his colleagues used a different strategy to make the adhesive they call geckskin. They theorized that the easily reversible adhesion of the gecko's footpads is not dependent solely upon those microscopic hairs, but also on the unique internal anatomy of the lizard's foot. So they set out to simulate the anatomy in an adhesive material.
To actually recreate the tendon and the skin, which we believe play a really important role in adhesion, and then we actually use what was called a draping adhesive. So the geck skin actually uses some elements of what geckos have. It uses their anatomy, but doesn't actually recreate these hairs that geckos have. The bottom line is our adhesive can then hold really large weights on smooth surface, much like a gecko, and can be peeled much like a gecko.
To recreate the unique arrangement of tendons that connect bone to skin in the gecko's foot, Alfred Crosby, a polymer scientist at UMass, says researchers wove a soft pad into a stiff fabric and bound it together with a caulk-like rubber compound. He says the pad mimics the way a gecko's foot pad drapes over a surface for maximum contact.
Another important development was that we understood in order for it to maintain stiffness to kind of the force that's being applied, you needed a tendon. And so we actually stitched the tendon into the skin. The tendon is simply just another piece of fabric.
The result is a 406 square millimeter piece of geck skin, about the size of an index card, that can hold more than 317 kilograms against a vertical surface and be removed with a simple tug without leaving a sticky residue like tape. The material can easily secure a large flat-screen television against a wall. Funding for the geck skin project was provided by the U.S. government's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA. DARPA hopes to use geck skin in its Z-Man project, which is studying ways to allow soldiers and other special operatives to climb walls like Spider-Man. Duncan Ershik and Alfred Crosby described the development of geck skin in the journal Advanced Materials. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
New guidelines have been released to help HIV-infected people get on treatment and stay on it. The recommendations appear in the Annals of Internal Medicine. Joe DiCapua reports.
The 37 guidelines were developed by a panel of experts at the International Association of Physicians in AIDS Care, or IAPAC. Co-chair, Dr. John Nushega, is a scientist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and a professor of medicine at South Africa's Stellenbosch University.
This guideline has been somewhat long overdue. We realized that after 30 years of HIV/AIDS, we still have patients with problem of taking their tablets at prescribed schedule. which obviously tend to make them sick, get hospitalized, and die.
He says the guidelines are designed to help both the patient and the healthcare provider. Not taking antiretroviral drugs as prescribed can allow HIV to come back even stronger.
The consequence is the virus keep multiplying, and the multiplication lead to drug resistance. You end up having drug which no longer work. You need to rely on even more complex and costly drug, which in some region of the world not available. So it's really problematic.
Newer antiretrovirals have made HIV/AIDS more of a chronic disease in many developed countries. Nevertheless, the Centers for Disease Control says even in the United States, many people fail to take advantage of treatment. It says only 69% of HIV-positive persons enter care, and only 59% remain in care. What's more, only 28% of Americans living with HIV have received enough treatment to have undetectable viral loads in their blood. Recent studies have shown that treatment is also prevention.
Someone who takes this tablet correctly is less likely to transmit the virus to his partner.
The recommendations include intensive outreach programs to help ensure those diagnosed with HIV get into treatment programs. There would also be systematic monitoring of patients on whether they're adhering to their treatment. Education and counseling programs are recommended so patients understand the importance of regularly scheduled doses. The guidelines also call for screening, managing, and treatment of depression and other mental illnesses, as well as pediatric and adolescent-focused therapeutic support.
We hope to update this recommendation every 2-3 years, obviously, because as more data are found, we can update our recommendation.
The International Association of Physicians in AIDS Care and the U.S. National Institutes of Health jointly sponsored the recommendations. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is Science World on VOA. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
A year after the devastating Japanese earthquake, scientists from all over the world continue to analyze the huge amount of data provided by what they call the best recorded earthquake of all time. Seismologist Dr. Zigao Peng, an associate professor in the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology, came up with a unique way to utilize and share some of that information with others. He took the seismic waves created by the earthquake and its aftershocks and then converted them into audio files so that you could actually hear what the quake sounded like as it traveled through the earth. That's what the 2011 Japanese earthquake sounded like. I took this audio from a sample of Dr. Peng's work that's also available on the Internet. Dr. Zigao Peng joins us for this week's one-on-one segment, and he tells us about his work in producing the sounds of the 2011 Japan Magnitude 9 earthquake. Professor, I read that last year's 9.0 quake in Japan is the best recorded earthquake of all time. Now, what does that mean, and how did that tragic earthquake become the best recorded?
Basically, we have to go back to 1995. There was a magnitude 6.9 earthquake occurring in Kobe, and that event created big casualties and a lot of damages. So immediately after that earthquake, the Japanese government started a huge investment to put thousands of very high-quality instruments, seismometers and geodetic instruments across the entire island of Japan. And those type of investment have paid off. So last year, when the magnitude 9.0 earthquake happens, those instruments are already in place. Because of that, this would definitely result in what we consider is the best recorded earthquake in all the human history.
Professor, I understand that you've taken the earthquake seismic waves and then converted them into audio files so that we can actually hear what the earthquake sounded like. Why did you do this, and how were you able to do it?
Well, the basic motivation for us to do that is because we want to come up with ways to convey the information, scientific knowledge to general audience, And normally the way we did is we use visual information, we use graphics. However, sometimes it turns out that it's better to use audio sound to convey the information knowledge. The reason is because for the ground shaking, the earthquake, the shaking itself is actually very similar to the sound we hear by our ear. So in this case, our ear is almost like an instrument, like a seismometer. So because of this similarity, that we can simply take the data recorded by seismometers and just by some simple modifications, we can actually hear how the ground shakes during and immediately after the big event.
Now, I understand for us humans to be able to hear these clips, you had to wind up playing the data faster than the true speed.
Right. Again, the reason is because our human ear can hear pretty much from 20 hertz up to a few kilohertz. Well, for most of the seismic data, it would record it up to, let's say, 50 hertz or 100 hertz or so. So in most cases, that we cannot hear the earthquake itself. Some you can hear the shakings or the window cracking, but that's the secondary effect. You cannot hear this, like the vibration of the ground. So we have to do some modification. The easiest way to modify the data is simply just play it faster. It's like when in old days we have those cassette players, you just play it the faster speed, now you can hear the higher pitch. So the same idea applies here, that by applying those data in a faster way, we can convert those seismic data that in a lower frequency range into the range that our ear can hear it.
Can you tell us where these recordings were made? I mean, so when we're listening to one clip, what perspective are we getting of the audio?
There are three clips we put up online. The first two actually recorded in the island of Japan itself. And in particular, the first one was recorded very close to the Manshak epicenter. So basically what you can hear in those cases, you can hear the details of the main event. And the second one, you can not only hear the main event, but also the immediate aftershocks. You can hear a lot of the pops and, you know, like fire cracks. Those are the aftershocks corresponding to the plate adjustment after the main event have happened. Now, the third one was actually recorded in California, which is about 6,000 miles away from Japan. And in that case, not only can hear the distant event as a loud sounder, but in addition to that, you can also hear some kind of channeling or like rainfall that's associated with the subtle fault movement that was induced by the Japan event as the seismic wave hit California. So to summarize that, you can actually use in this type of sound and videos to represent seismic data pretty much all around the world, from Japan to the other side.
And finally, Professor, since the earthquake was so well recorded around the world, all this data being available, have we learned anything new that could help us predict and or pinpoint the location of such destructive quakes in the future?
Well, scientists are still working very hard on understand, again, to see what's going on, in particular to see what the next big earthquake is. Unfortunately, at this time, that we still cannot accurately predict the location, time, and magnitude of next big event. The reason is because the Earth is a very complex system, and unfortunately, we have to rely on the data that's collected on the surface to understand what's going on and 10 to 20 miles below the depths. So at this point, I have to say that we are still very far from, let's say, accurately predict the event. But on the other hand, the massive data set we have obtained from this earthquake have already give us a much better understanding of basically how the earthquake have started and how it propagated and evolved. So eventually, those information would provide vital input for scientists to better understand when and where the big earthquake is going to happen. Even though we're still not at a stage that with those data we can then tell what's the big one's going to happen next, I think that those data would help scientists to understand the fundamental basics of how earthquakes happen and where they're going to happen.
That was Dr. Zgao Peng, a seismologist at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta, Georgia. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more, so stop by and visit us on the Internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Bantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.